Hi, everyone, and welcome to Focus Forward, an executive function podcast where we explore the challenges and celebrate the wins you'll experience as you change your life through working on improving your executive function skills. I'm your host, Hannah Choi. Okay, so today's episode is one I am especially excited to share with you. Whether you are an expert in the field of executive function skills or you're just starting out learning about these essential skills for life success, you'll want to listen. I have to say that as a self-professed nerd when it comes to EF skills, I felt like I was a guest at a little party of EF professionals. Funnily enough, when we recorded this, I had COVID, so I was grateful to still be able to attend the party in my pajamas since it was held virtually. Okay, so who was at this party? I am so happy to have been joined once again by the OG of EF, Ellen Galinsky, who sat down with me on Focus Forward in March of 2024 when her book, The Breakthrough Years, came out. More recently, you may have heard Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg and I and me talk about Ellen's important work in episode 62 about Lighthouse Parenting. In addition to author of Mind in the Making and The Breakthrough Years, Ellen is the president of the Families and Work Institute and the elected president of the Work and Family Researchers Network. She also serves as senior research advisor to AASA, the School Superintendent Organization. Previously, she was the chief science officer at the Bezos Family Foundation and faculty at Bank Street College. Her research has focused on the impact of work life on families, child and adolescent development, youth voice, childcare, parent-professional relationship, and parental development. Ellen's work has contributed deeply to how we understand children's learning and development and how we, as adults, can nurture it. My second EF party guest is Dr. Megan McClelland, an internationally recognized expert on school readiness and self-regulation in very young children. She is the Catherine E. Smith Professor of Human Development and Family Sciences at Oregon State University, where she also directs the Hallie E. Ford Center for Healthy Children and Families. Megan's research focuses on optimizing children's development, especially as it relates to children's self-regulation, early learning, and school success. Her recent work has examined links between self-regulation and long-term outcomes from early childhood to adulthood, which you'll hear about today, and intervention efforts to improve these skills in young children. She is currently involved with multiple national and international projects to develop measures of self-regulation and improve school success in young children. And Megan is also the co-author of Stop, Think, Act, an excellent book all about how we as educators and parents can help our kids strengthen their EF skills through play. So today you're going to hear us talk about why executive function skills matter and how we can help kids strengthen them through everyday activities. Megan and Ellen help parents and educators see that we learn when we play. Whether you're a parent, an educator, or just someone who cares about kids' success and adult success in the long run, this episode is full of insights you won't want to miss. Okay, let's get on with the show. All right, welcome to the podcast, Megan and Ellen. I'm so happy to have you back, Ellen and Megan. I'm so glad to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we are going to talk about executive function skills and how important they are at all stages of life. And Megan, I know because of your particular interest or your particular research area is all about little kids and executive function skills, which is a passion of mine. I really love. I used to work with little kids before I started mostly working with adolescents and adults. And so they're always kind of my like, I kind of have like a special spot for them. So could we, I don't know, could we just kind of get into explaining or let's dive into why executive function skills are so important in little kids and what we can do to, you know, to help kids. That was not worded very well, but I'll end.
No, do you want me to start or do you want Ellen to?
Megan, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, you go, okay. Megan.
Well, when, you know, we started thinking and looking for important things that are predicting long-term outcomes and life outcomes, and, you know, we kind of stumbled upon this group of skills that were somehow learning related back when I was in graduate school. And, It was, they're kind of foundational skills, but they're, and so where did, then I got really curious about where those skills were coming from. Were they just social skills? Were they more cognitive skills? But they didn't seem to be, they seemed to be both of those things almost, So then that kept us investigating. And as, and when you do, the wonderful thing about being a researcher is you get, you're curious. And you continue to explore different things, and one thing leads you to this, and it's really important because then you discover important things. And so one of the things that happened was we started with these sort of learning skills, and then we started investigating the importance of them. And then what happened was I had a colleague who had data from children between ages 4 and 25, from this adopted study. And it was kind of unusual because at first I thought, well, I want to collaborate with this person because they're great and it would be fun. But I haven't really looked at this kind of data before. And so we tried to look for some things we were both interested in the data set. And one of the things I said was, I study sort of these sort of self-regulation kinds of skills that are, help kids listen and follow directions. They're kind of like self-control. And so they had this set of skills, these questions in this data set, starting at age 4, looking, really asking parents of all people in a way, about attention and persistence through difficulty. And not sometimes when you just ask parents, I mean, I'm a parent, I think my kids are brilliant, obviously, and so sometimes we're not the most objective. And so I thought, well, I don't know about this, but they were really concrete questions. And that was very helpful. And so they were very specific and concrete. And they asked things like, how well your child can persist through difficult tasks and maintain attention and focus. And so they really kind of got to the underlying, those foundational cognitive skills I was, looking at already. And so we were able to look longitudinally. And they also, interestingly, I was also interested in academic outcomes and how do we help kids to be successful in school and academically. And so they also had data on math and reading skills from ages 8, at ages 8, 12, 16, and 21 from the same group of kids that were adopted and non-adopted kids. And so they went from age 4 to age 25. And what was crazy, honestly, was we, and I was very lucky to work with a very talented and well-known statistician, methodologist, whose real gift is translating the statistics into what this actually means. So we were doing our analyses, and he says to me, his name's Alan Aycock, and he says, Megan, when we put them all in the model, all these things we're looking long term at, from between attention and persistence at age 4 to things like important outcomes at the end of the data, which was actually how likely were they to graduate from college or university. And we had these reading and math skills. He said, what we found to our surprise actually was the strongest predictor of the odds of completing college was a child's age 4 attention and persistence skills. And that was even when we put all these things into this longitudinal pathway, cascade almost of, we included their reading and math skills at ages 8, 12, 16, and 21. And the strongest predictor of your odds of finishing university by the time you were 25 years old was not the math and reading skills. It was actually your age 4 attention and persistence, which was really surprising to us. And he had this really incredible ability to say, you realize that what if you have high attention and persistence skills at age 4, you're almost 50% more likely to graduate from
That's
university by
amazing.
the time you're 25. And I was like, nah.
Yeah, that's hard to believe.
Really? And so we kept looking at, and thankfully we had two statisticians on the paper, and we took into account all the things. And it was just fascinating because it really put into some practical language, the importance of these skills quite early on. And then that led us, in some ways, we are also working on how do we measure these skills in fun and easy to use ways that are feasible and practical. And then how would we improve them in young kids because they seem to be important later on.
And if I could jump in, I read that paper where you showed that attention span persistence at age 4 gave young people at 25 almost a 50% greater likelihood of graduating from college and practically drop the journal. Or I can't believe it. I mean, you don't get statistics like that in
Yeah, it was
real life. You
crazy.
know, you just don't see anything that is quite so powerfully predictive. And it was, I had also been looking at executive function skills in young children and thought, whoa, I have to meet this Megan.
And she did, and it was fun. And look, that was like 15 years ago, almost, maybe 12
Love
years ago.
it. I love it. So, what was your next step from there, Megan?
Well, we had been already kind of developing this measure in collaboration with colleagues. So basically, it was like these skills seem to be important. If they're really, and we had also done some other work saying that they predicted on top of whatever you call intelligence, right? So we had these kids that had 564 kids had IQ measures of IQ, which is a fairly narrow way to assess intelligence. But there was some idea that just smarter kids just were better at academic, outcomes. And so we thought, well, we should test this. And so we did. And we found that these skills predicted on top of a child's whatever their IQ score was. And so lots of other people have found the same thing. Clancy Blair very famously has also or had, also had found that. And so that kind of cemented, these importance of these skills on top of other things that we need to take into account or people thought were the most important things. So then you think, well, how would you measure those out there in the real world with little kids in real world settings so that they're more reliable and valid and they're more related to their everyday behavior, honestly? And then how if they're malleable, are they malleable? That was a question. And then how would we improve them? And so we had still continued, my colleagues and I have two lines of work, and one is this measurement piece. And we have a game with my colleague Claire Cameron that's called the head, toes, knees, shoulders task. It takes about 5 minutes, and it's quite predictive of how kids do academically, especially in math. And similar to other similar kinds of executive function tasks. So we're really looking at these underlying cognitive foundational skills of, inhibitory control, cognitive flexibility, and working memory.
It's always the one I forget.
There's lots of ones you can include. I mean, so in a nutshell, we typically look at attention, cognitive flexibility, inhibitory control. Some people call it self-control, and then also memory, working memory, especially your ability to take in and process information, right? And figure out how, remember what you need to do in a multi-step activity and then execute or do it. And then, so the reason that these measures work quite well is they tend to require children, they ask kids to pay attention, focus. They have to remember the instructions. They have to have some kind of inhibitory control. And we ask them to do the opposite. And so we say, when I say touch your head, instead of touching your head, I want you to touch your toes.
Cognitive
When I say
flexibility.
touch your toes, instead of touching your toes, I want you to touch your head. So you're doing
Cool.
something that's different or the
Cool.
opposite. And then you add in new rules and then you switch the rules. So you can see how it really does tap kids' ability to focus. They have to pay attention, they have to remember the instructions, and then they have to switch. And it's quite challenging. And so that's been really a good one avenue of our work that's we've been working on for a while, this little measure. And then we've been working on what do you do, honestly, if these skills are important. Okay, we can measure them in reliable and valid ways. Then what do you do to improve them? Can they be improved? And that's where the research comes in. That's super important with starting to test and replicate. And because you find these things you don't expect to be so important, that's the value of this kind of educational research, because it makes these discoveries. And you have to test, and you have to then replicate and try it out again to really test the effectiveness with quite rigorous trials. And that's why federal funding is so important in this area, because we are showing really substantive improvements in kids' academic outcomes.
That work that we do for these little kids when they're little, I mean, you saw it. It makes a huge difference. If we can find out that the actions that we can take to support the development of their executive function skills when they're little, I mean, that's better for the future of everything, right? Their individual lives, but then also, the collective sort of future.
One of the things that struck me in Megan's research is that if you take the head to toe, knee to shoulder, did I do that right? I always get the shoulder and the knee
I
mixed
know, it's okay. That's why it's a good measure, I
head to toe, knee to
guess.
shoulder. If you think about it, those are games that people have played for centuries. I mean, Mother May I, Red Light, Green Light, Simon Says, all of those games tax, have children pay attention, remember the rules, switch the rules when they change, so that they're flexibly, cognitively, and then not go on automatic. And those games have been playing such an important role in the building blocks of kids' ability to learn. I mean, I think the important thing about executive function skills is that they underlie all learning. And I'm thinking of now the research that Adele Diamond and Daphne Ling did, where they first looked at about 85 experiments in 2016 that intended to improve executive function skills, and went on in 2020 to add, close to 200 interventions to improve executive function skills. And they concluded that these skills are more important, or as important, as kids' IQ and socioeconomic background. And they're, like Megan found, more predictive of school success in the early years than early reading and early math. And what is important here, if you take a brain perspective, is that the brain is forming the connection. The architecture of the brain is being built at this time. It's forming the connections that underlie the development of these skills. So there's a sensitive period, if you want to use scientific terms. You can call it a readiness to learn these skills when kids are young. There's also a readiness in adolescence that I think we're making a huge mistake. So I echo what you're saying, Megan, about how important your research has been showing that these skills aren't just inherited. That they can be taught, they can be improved, and they can be improved in ways that affect school and life success. And so this kind of research helps us know not just that they're important, but then how to promote them. And we've used your skills, your head to toe, knee to shoulder exercise, and your other games, interventions, to try to help kids improve skills as well. These are just things that teachers can do during circle time, that parents can do when their kids are driving them crazy because they have to wait for something. And not only are they helping the time go more quickly, but they're teaching kids these incredible skills that underlie all learning at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's someone could say, well, if we're doing these, if we've done these kinds of games forever, like, what's the big deal? This is just common sense. And I think the real value in this kind of work, especially when you test it quite rigorously, and just being able to discover important things like this is, it's actually, there's something about these skills that you have to continue to exercise, right? And they actually have to get harder over time. So it's not like if you're just going to play these games one off here and one off there, that's going to have the results you want. There's actually some really important things that have to happen, the components, the key ingredients that make this stuff effective. And that is not common sense. There's actually some really important brain research that we know and brain understanding we know that is involved in this. And there's also some very systematic. So when we have our it's red light, purple light intervention games, it's not like you just come out and you do a game. It's like you actually have to build what they call the cognitive complexity. That means that over time, kids are going to get better at a game. You have to add in new rules, new things that continue to exercise this part of your brain, honestly, and help kids practice these skills, not on a computer. I mean, because when I, you know, people say, well, there's all these brain games on the computer. Well, that will help you get really good. If you get good at that game, you're going to be really good at those games. But they don't have something called far transfer effects, which means it's really hard then to remember where you parked your car, literally, like me. And so you don't generalize. And so then, if this is important, it's not just common sense because there's a missing ingredient, you know, to, and there's a real importance of following kind of this work and having these key ingredients that have to be there for this improvement to take place. They have to be practiced, you know, out there in the real world in everyday settings. We have to train teachers on doing these games, but intentionally adding in new rules and games that continue to get harder over time, that increase the ability for kids to be challenged and to practice these skills. That is the thing that in one study we found that for some of the kids in our study, we found a 1 year of math learning occurred in the kids that got access to these games. A 1 year of math learning occurred in 6 months. That's substantive. That has real payoffs.
The other reason that they're not common sense is that, and I can tell you because I visit schools all the time, because I work as an advisor to the school superintendent organization. So we're out looking at schools on site visits, you know, a couple of times a year. And what I see is that there's an emphasis in early childhood programs to say kids need to learn to read and they need to learn the fundamentals of math. And I see them gamified. They'll turn them into little cue cards that kids play, and they're teaching the TH sound and not connecting it to reality. And in the course of that, they're taking away things like circle time, reading to kids, playing, the other things that are so foundational to building these skills. So, in education, in a desire, early education, in a desire to boost these kids' ability in life, are doing things that are actually diminishing from it.
I
A
agree.
lot of research, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek's new research, where she's developed ways to promote playful learning in math all the way up into the early grades, is showing that we need kids to have these abilities taxed in real life settings over and over and over again in ways that are meaningful. And so you know, I think the other thing that I wanted to say is that once people discovered executive function skills, there was oh wow, you know, we've got the secret ingredient in the sauce, you know, this is the silver bullet or whatever analogy you want to use. And so they were either doing them in one-off activities in a lab where kids got good at doing them in a lab, but they couldn't bring them back into their everyday life, or they had a class and then was disconnected from everything else. And so what studies have found is that you need to do them in real life. You need to name the skill that's being used so that kids become aware of the skill. You need to use reflection. So I include actually in the way I think about executive function skills, even though it doesn't take place in the executive, you know, the cognitive control part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, it takes place in the default network. I include reflection, but you need to be able to think retrospectively or prospectively. You need to reflect about when did I use this skill in the past and it helped me, and when can I use it in the future? And you need to be able to increase its complexity and keep pushing it in real life in ways that are meaningful and kids care about. And you need to be able to name to teach other kids, kids teaching other kids, which is why Adele Diamonds and other people's studies have shown that kids are more likely to learn these skills in soccer, in exercise, in orchestra, in places where they have coaching, because what really helps them is for adults to see the world through skill building glasses and then find everyday moments to be able to promote these skills.
I mean, that's that what you just said is exactly what I even what prompted me to reach out to you was that I wanted to show people that executive function skills are not skills that can be or really should be, as you just said, taught like in this sort of like prescriptive, isolated situation. They really are being learned in ev like every day, every single day.
I had a graduate student, a really creative student named Derek Becker, who's now a professor. But when he was really interested in physical activity and sports, and I said, okay. But what was great is when you're a researcher and you have students who are curious, and we also have strengths here in exercise and sports science. He teamed up with someone. He started looking at different kinds of sports, and it gets back to Ellen's comment about the importance of everyday activities and sports. And certain kinds of sports tended, he found, really did improve or help children with executive function. So he looked at elementary school children who participated in what he called, well, not him, but just him, but other people called what they call open skilled or closed skilled sports. And what that actually is how complex the sport is. So, for example, soccer, you have to actually, there's a lot of visual, spatial kinds of reasoning that is needed. You have to remember what you have to do. You have to be really paying attention. You have to change. There's a lot of flexibility that's required, right? Those things are really actually helpful, that kind of activity. I'm thinking also of like martial arts. Adele Diamond talked about that. We found also with specific like dance, specific like ballet, where you have to be very focused. You have to remember choreography. I'm a dancer, so of course I'm a little biased here, but I think that these kinds of sports that require, complexity, they're called open skill sports versus closed skill sports, which are like you do the same repetitive motion over and over and over. Maybe, potentially running or swimming, where there's not, depending if you don't have a lot of complexity and change. It was a really interesting, there's been a lot of research also that crosses over, that's interdisciplinary, that has now been looking at sort of the importance of these kinds of skills or the links between these skills and activity, physical activity, and different kinds of sports.
It's so funny, like thinking back as a child who was not diagnosed with ADHD early enough, I think, oh, no wonder I was so bad at those kind of sports because I could not pay attention and remember and like do all the things that are required to be a good soccer player.
Sports can help you learn
Yeah,
that.
I
I've
should have stuck
had
with
people in
it.
my life who have ADHD and who play soccer.
Yeah,
It helps them in, it
I'm
helps them in life, it
sure.
helps them in school, it helps them give up their phones when they
Yeah.
don't want to.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh.
That's right. When parents come to me and they ask, my kid, I don't know what to do. They're all over, they're bouncing off the
Yeah.
walls.
Yeah.
You have to engage them in fun ways. And so I say, well, what are they interested in? Is there some, what's the hook, to get them really? And some these kinds of activities and sports can be, now there's a threshold. You don't want to do it, over so much that it becomes a real stress point or so many activities. That's also quite stressful for kids. But I think there's a real benefit for them to learn discipline, focus, all these skills in things like martial arts and things like dance and things like soccer, gymnastics, all those things that require this kind of persistence. Oh boy, persistence. Really important for those skills. I mean, those sports for sure.
I mean, I think that we think of learning as, which is another thing that I just adore about your research. We think of learning as being sit down, shut up, and stay still, and actually look at what kids are learning through games like the Circle Time games. I
Yeah.
mean, where they're physically active, they're all in. They're socially, emotionally, cognitively involved. And you talked earlier about this isn't just a social skill, this isn't just a cognitive skill, it isn't just an emotional skill. It brings those capacities together to achieve goals. And so we need to understand that how important physical learning is to even the sit down, kind of learning. But I think that there's a move for teachers to also think of themselves more as coaches, to restructure classrooms. There's work that's going on with Carol Brazil at Arizona State University, where she's arguing for restructuring classrooms so it's not just one teacher and whatever 20, 30 something children, but or big kids, little kids, but having group teachers where the teachers can be more of coaches, so that learning, so that the teacher can be there in the moment with the child, and the kids can also learn from each other.
Ellen, I know you and I have talked before about Tools of the Mind, the curriculum for kindergarten and first grade, right? And my daughter went through that. So I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about how that program f really is aligned with all of this work.
Yeah, Tools of the Mind. I'm on the board, so honesty and transparency
Transparency.
and advertising.
It's a good board to be on, Ellen.
No, I'm a fan. That's why they asked me to be on their board. Is one of the few complete curricular approaches that promotes executive function skills, and it's ever creative. Deb Leong, who's one of the founders of it, has things like now she's experimenting with how handwriting can be used as a way into reading. And so but the heart of the program is sociodramatic play, where kids do pretend activities as a way of building their skills. They have all kinds of very clever things in it. Study buddies is another thing. If it isn't just the teacher asking the question and the kids holding up their hand, and when three kids get to answer and the other kids are fidgeting or not paying attention. I mean, Kathy Hirsch Pasek's new research shows how often kids are bored in school, and the wonderful new research of Jenny Anderson and Rebecca Winthrop shows that only 10% are really of kids are in, truly engaged. My figure was, more like 40, 50%, but in a self-report, but hers is lower. But yeah, so what Study Buddies does is that a teacher might ask a question and then kids discuss it with each other. And you pay, don't pair in schools so often, kids get grouped by abilities. In this, it's very important not to group kids by abilities because you have all kids helping other kids. And to be a helper is so important in kids' development, not just to be helped, but to also be the helper. And then they discuss it, and then the conversation really truly involves the whole group of whatever it is. It's much more
Which,
of an inquiry
yeah.
based.
And that goes right along with what you were saying, Megan, earlier about how kids need to be able to talk about it and learn the words and know how to express it and also teach other kids and share with other kids. So, yeah.
Taking so I think what Ellen just said, I just want to emphasize one piece, which is, having giving kids autonomy to and independence, right? To lead the way. And also that sociodramatic play is helpful for reflection too, because it helps kids think about what they have to do. So that whole sort of idea of theory of mind, we call it, and metacognition, where you have to start understanding that your perspective is different from someone else. You may not
Yes.
want to play the way you want to play this game, is really important. And I think that's why I just love Kathy and Roberta's work around that playful learning, because it really is quite cognitively challenging for kids to have to do all those things, right? And we discount the importance of those skills. But just to also say that a piece of our red light, purple light intervention in the Circle Time games is honestly having kids have the ability to take turns being the leader. So they actually get to be the one. That's really helpful for them too. And autonomy support, I have to say, is extremely important because it can't be one directional. That the kids have to be able to get scaffolded, but then they need to be able to have the autonomy and independence to practice this, those skills and take the lead.
This is wonderful research that Stephanie Carlson and other people have done. She's at the University of Minnesota, and she and a group of people were asking, so which kids are better, have better executive function skills? And they went back and looked at how they're parented. And one of the experiments they did was to give kids puzzles that were too hard for them, preschool kids puzzles that were too hard for them, and then look at how the parents interacted with them. And she found that parents did three things. One is they stepped back and did nothing, sort of under controlling or laissez-faire. They jumped in and did the whole puzzle for the kids. They put that piece in, it had it upside down. They just took it and put it right side up. Or they were autonomy supportive. And autonomy supportive is that you gave the child careful hints, like look at the shape of the piece you're holding. Maybe you want to turn that shape different ways to see if it would fit. So you didn't take over and do it for the child. What researchers would call scaffold, you kept the supports there until they weren't needed anymore. And those parents who were autonomy supportive had the kids who were the most, who had the better executive function skills.
It's hard as a parent. I mean, I study this stuff. I'm supposed to know. And I remember thinking to myself, Megan, do not do your daughter's Play-Doh, activity for her. Like, what am I thinking? I almost had to whack myself, because it's just, I think our nature to try, especially if you're in a hurry. Honey, let's just go. And just letting them have the, oh my gosh, the ability and the freedom to figure it out themselves is just such a gift we can give our kids. Not without, completely stepping back, but with boundaries and with what Ellen talked about, scaffolding. It's just really helpful.
Yeah, no, I struggle with my grandson. Sometimes
Oh, I'm
lying.
so glad to hear
What am I
that.
doing? Why am I tying his shoes? He can learn to tie his shoes.
You just made me feel so
Now
much
he's
better.
12, he doesn't need them any, his shoes tied anymore. But doing that stuff where I also study it and know not to do it. And
Even when you've done something right? When you have adolescents and they say, Mom, you don't have to tell me. I actually did that before you said anything. And I'm like, okay.
And that's when autonomy support is particularly powerful, as you know, Hannah, from working with kids that age. It's so important. And we did as you know, for the breakthrough years, we did a nationally representative study of parents, and we could look at to what extent parents fix things for kids versus help children learn the skills to fix things for themselves through a whole set of processes. That Stephanie and I worked out together, check on yourself, like, or what's your, are you, how are you feeling about this? If it's making you anxious, you probably are going to jump in. And then taking the child's view, which would be, what is your child capable of? Can they tie their shoes or can't they? Yes, they can. Or, and then joint problem solving or choices or giving children the supports that they need to be able to solve it for themselves. All of those things are so important in being autonomy supportive. So
In so many of the conversations that I've had recently with parents of kids of all different ages, I have noticed that that seems to be the part that they are most surprised about when I suggest is like get your kid involved in that decision and find out what your kid wants and what your kid how your kid could participate in that and they're surprised. Oh, I should do that, huh?
I mean, we found only 23% of parents, by the measures that we were looking at, were autonomy supportive. And so it's so great you're pointing it out to them because joint problem solving, as you know, with teenage kids yourself, leads to a lot less strife with teenagers than trying to fix it for them when they say, Mom.
Completely. And then they correct you. When you try to do too much, I mean, they're like, whoa, hello, actually, I got this. And you're like, oh boy, you're right.
I just had this experience where my daughter needed a prescription refilled, and our pharmacy uses an app, which is great. But she was asking me to refill it for her, which I then had to like write it down, make sure I remember to refill it, and then go pick it up. And then I thought, wait a second, maybe she could have her own version of the app and she could order it. So I set her up with the app. And then yesterday, I heard, or my husband told me, he's like, yeah, I gotta go pick up our daughter's prescription. And I was like, oh. So it had happened.
Brilliant.
She had run out like a couple months ago. I set her up with it and then she did it. She ordered it. But then I was like, oh.
I know exactly. This is how I feel too. Because
One thing I want to say about executive function skills, because some people, I go around, I just was in Illinois for a couple of days last week, and I ask people in the audience if they've heard of executive function skills. More and more are. It used to be almost no one, now it's more. But if I ask them to define them, they define them as as compliance skills, you know, putting tabs on your notebook, being organized in class, being able to prioritize. So what I think we, Hannah, you, Megan, me, Megan, Ellen, what we and other people have to do is help people understand that these underlie all learning and that they involve creative thinking. Not just, you know, they really involve that autonomy that we've been talking about.
One of the parents that I was talking about, we part of or talking to part of what we talked about was how she was realizing that she did things differently than her child, and that she was starting to see why expecting her child to do it the same way that she did it was causing friction.
Oh, interesting. I think
So
that's
if you don't know that, if no one's ever told you or you've never learned or just never had that realization, then of course you would expect, well, everybody just thinks this way, right? Everybody's brains work this
perspective taking. That's an executive
way.
function.
It is.
I would just come back to one thing that Ellen talked about before, which is like creativity, because I also really think that when you allow kids the freedom and autonomy to figure things out and develop those attention and persistence and focus skills, they're a lot more likely to problem solve in ways that don't are not compliant. They're very creative problem solving and they figure it out and they in ways that surprise you and you go, oh, wow, that's an interesting idea. And we need that in this society. We don't need more of the rote memorization anymore. We need the creative problem solving and we need the take initiative skills. Those things are really, I think, founded in these executive function skills.
They are. And I was at a session 2 weeks ago at the executive at the AASA national conference, and one person said, you know, there's a whole lot of discussion, is AI replacing people and is AI good or is AI bad? And you know, like, AI, what are we going to do with it? And he said, the jobs that AI is going to replace are the kind of rote jobs that Megan was talking about. The creative thinking jobs, like how do we deal with a pandemic, or you know, what do we do in the new world that we're all living in, this world that is so challenging? Those are the skills that we need our children and we need to have ourselves. And we need them, just like the parent you were talking about, Hannah, we need them.
We do.
This is not just about little kids,
No.
it's
No.
about us.
I was
We're
just going to
resilient.
say that we as adults need to be able to be think flexibly enough to be like, oh, that's actually a really good idea.
It builds resilience too, because then you figure out, wow, okay, this is very challenging right now. How do I figure out how, a solution in spite of this? How do we do good work, right? Anyway, how do we figure out how to support our children regardless of all the other things happening, right? And so I think it does help us. It's a protective factor for so many kids, you know,
Absolutely.
especially
Which is why,
regardless of their background. Sorry.
yeah, I mean, Phil Zelazo at the University of Minnesota's work has found that strong executive function skills are very predictive of mental health, you know, mental health well-being, if you want to turn that
Makes
word around.
sense.
It's not just academic success. It's our emotional, social, well-being too.
So the importance in children, the importance of having strong executive function skills in children supports, or strong executive function skills in children supports them as adolescents, which supports them as young adults, and then supports them as they become adults who are then supporting young children. I mean, you can't argue that that is, I mean, they are essential skills.
They are. They're not everything, but they're an important key ingredient. When you think about all the key ingredients, I think, there's so much we don't know, about how do we do this in ways that really work. And so that's why the work, the research is important.
I was just gonna say it goes back to the importance of supporting research, and not just for the littles, right? To supporting research in adolescence, like all
There's a
the
lot less research in adolescence on executive function skills. I know when I went to write the breakthrough years, I was looking and calling up all my friends and saying, who should I talk to? Who should I talk to? And there's a whole lot less of it, more than there used to be, but a whole lot less. A lot of it is not in this country too.
That's
But
right.
it's really important that, I just want to underline what Megan is saying. If she hadn't been able to do that research, we wouldn't know the tools that we need to have as adults, as parents, as educators, as community members, to help our kids thrive in such a rapidly changing, complex, challenging world.
So that makes me think, if someone is listening right now and they say, well, I feel like my kids are not learning that in school. Where do they go to find out about that? Where do they go to make that happen in their school?
Well, I'll jump in. One of the things that we did when we worked with the Bezos Foundation was to create, and Megan and other groups of researchers helped us. We created 1,000 tips for taking everyday moments and turning them into, Jackie Bezos would call them skill, brain building moments. So there are free tips that are on the web called Vroom, Vroom, like the sound the kids made, vroom, 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 which is why we named it what we named it, that are there. They're Megan's wonderful circle time games, which you can read about, which teachers can, you'll see
Implement
how they can
tomorrow.
impact
Yeah.
things. But in the meantime, you can be a skill spotter, so like a coach, spot those everyday moments when you see your child either needing to use or having used a skill that we've been talking about on this time together, and point that skill out and name it,
I would just add, in addition to all those things, there are like really good resources like this podcast and other kinds of things. And that I will say that there's, the Institute for Education Sciences has put out a number of really useful practice guides that are based on very extremely rigorous research, like very, very rigorous research. And one of them is called Preparing Young Children for School. And the idea there is that an educator, an early educator, a teacher can open up this practice guide, and there are specific tips and activities they could do right away that don't cost money, that they can adapt for their classroom.
there's Mind in the Making. We have tips for reading books in ways that promote these skills, and we have what we call skill building moments, which is turning discipline challenges into opportunities to build skills. And then really importantly, there are people like you, Hannah, who are just expert coaches who can help parents and students strengthen their executive function skills. That's what you do, and that's just critically important. And while I don't think there's been a real recognition of the importance of these in education yet, but I think that's coming with AASA's new Teach the New Basics, Real Skills for Real Life. What's happened is that there have been wonderful coaching practices like yours that have spread that has spread around the country.
We have a division called Brain Tracks where we are that we've been building over the last few years, where we are supporting skill teachers, schools and teachers in learning about executive function skills and how their importance and how we can use them in the classroom. So
The reason Shauna Tominey and I wrote this book, it's called Stop, Think, Act, and it's kind of old now, but I will say the whole purpose was because we had all these kinds of people asking us for what to do. And we just said, well, here's a short little guide for teachers if you're interested. And the reason I mention is because it includes some of the games that we're talking about here, but it also talks about how do you adapt them for like PE or outdoor play
Oh,
or
cool.
in other contexts. And so it could be a useful guide.
Well, do either one of you want to add anything else to our conversation here? Any parting words?
I just really appreciate the interest and I think focus on these. I think they're really so foundational and they're so easy for us to do a lot to improve kids' outcomes. But it's not, it takes, the work, it takes, being intentional, it takes, knowing about these things. So I just really appreciate all the work you're doing and, to get the word out and the work you're doing to support kids and families.
Thank you.
I do too. I really appreciate the whole the sense of curiosity and discovery that has led to these breakthroughs in science, that has led to the possibilities of our being able to help more kids learn and thrive in school. We have challenges. Test scores are going down, mental health problems are going up. Too few kids are engaged in learning. This is not the only silver bullet, but it is a very important tool in our toolbox to help kids thrive and learn. It's a particularly important one and one that we're not paying enough attention to. So I'm very grateful to each of you for the research, for the practice in helping more kids learn and thrive, which has been the sole question that I've asked and all of the research that I've ever done, what can we best do to help kids learn and thrive from mind in the making to the breakthrough years to even the research that I did on work and family life?
Thank you,
Well
Ellen.
said. Well said.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, thank you both so much. I really appreciate your time and all the work that you're doing. And I feel hopeful, and I really hope that anyone who is listening agrees with us and really feels passionately about the importance of supporting this kind of research and this kind of thinking, right? Using our executive function skills to think about executive function skills.
How
So,
can you not? I mean, if you
right?
know something that is so powerful that could help kids, how can you not? How can you know that? I can't imagine.
And there's proof. This has all been proven by
Right. We
research.
have
So,
lots of really good work, and there's so many opportunities to improve kids' lives. We should be jumping all over it.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen. I don't know about you, but I was so surprised to learn how executive function skills in early childhood are such powerful predictors of long-term success. I knew they were important, right? I mean, I'm doing a podcast about them, but wow, strong attention skills at age 4 means you're 50% more likely to graduate from college. Oh, it's amazing. I hope that you take away from this episode that our abilities in these skills aren't fixed. This is something my co coaching colleagues and I see daily with our clients. EF skills can be taught, strengthened, and practiced through everyday experiences. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out to me at podcast@beyondbooksmart. And as Emily, a longtime listener, discovered last week, you never know what kind of fun and productive adventure you might go on when you reach out to me. If you're interested in trying out our MAP motivation and productivity program with morning accountability sessions, skill building workshops, and live work sprints for body doubling, visit our website at map.worksmartcoaching.com and sign up for our free 7-day trial. Come join the fun. Thank you for helping us spread the word about executive function skills, and we appreciate you sharing Focus Forward with your friends and colleagues, because word of mouth keeps us on the air. And don't forget to rate us wherever you listen, and if you have the time, a written review on Apple makes a really big difference for us. And a million thanks to Sean Potts, my super supportive editor and producer, and Maggie Hickey, who has been my partner in Canva lately.